There are many Christians who find themselves anxious, depressed, discouraged, even wondering, why should I even exist? These are really dark moments of the soul. And we can feel it in our culture, the constant feeling of pressure to do more, be more, compare ourselves. And it ends up warping our understanding of God and grace. And those words, they mean less and less to us because they've been shaped by our culture instead of shaped by God's word. I have the joy and privilege of interviewing David Zoll today about his new book, The Big Relief. And I am so excited for you to hear what he has to say. For those of us who need a fresh reminder of who God is for us and be reminded of how powerful grace is and how it gives us relief and joy and purpose in life and allows us to not take ourselves serious. Hopefully this will be encouraging to you. Stay tuned. Before we jump into today's interview, let's take a moment and look to Christ to encourage our hearts. We live in a world that never stops asking for more. Be more productive, be more disciplined, be more spiritual. And if we're honest, it's exhausting. Even in the church, we can fall into this same pattern, turning the good news of Jesus into another part of performance review. We know the right words about grace, but in our hearts, we still live like the Father's smile depends on how well we've done this week. So we keep striving, we compare, we measure, we fear. And deep down, we wonder if we'll ever feel like we've done enough. But here's the truth. The gospel was never meant to add pressure to your life. It was meant to relieve it. Grace is not a pat on the back for the nearly perfect. It's rest for the worn out, the anxious, the one who keeps falling short. Jesus did not come to give you another burden to carry. He came to carry the burden for you. He obeyed where you failed. He loved where you grow cold. He rested in the Father's approval so that you could rest in His. The good news is this: you do not have to prove yourself anymore. Christ has already proven everything on your behalf. So when guilt whispers, you should be doing more. When fear says, you're not enough. And when pride says, you can fix this yourself, look to Christ. He is your righteousness. He is your peace. And He is enough for every unfinished part of your life. In Him, you can finally breathe. You can stop pretending and you can rest. Because the gospel really is the big relief. The good news that the pressure is off and grace is on. Now, I look forward to you hearing from David about this very subject. All of Christ for all of life. All of Christ for all of life. Ooh. Welcome to Theocast, where we are going to be talking about all things Christ, all of Christ for all of life. I'm your host. I'm John Moffitt. I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. If you're in the area, I'd love to see you. I know many of you skipped the intro and then realized you lived in my town and never came and visited. This happened like a week ago. The guy moved to Chattanooga. He's like, I can't believe I was living there. So we're glad to have you here. And that tagline is important to me because I do want to talk about all things Christ as it relates to every area of our life. And a guy that does this well and has been a dear friend of mine and has written much on all of Christ for all of life in multiple books with me today is David Zoll. David, it is so good to have you back on the pod. It's been way too long.
Oh, thanks, John. It's such a joy, such a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, for sure. So, Dave, if did I hear correctly? I think I heard you recently say you've been doing Mockingbird ministry for 17 years. Is that right? Or close to that?
We're actually 19. We're getting close to 19 years. I know. That wow. Like big 2-0 is around the corner, and it's a little, you know, surreal to think about that.
Yeah.
Where did the time go?
Yeah. Yeah, tell people a little bit about, if they don't know, tell them a little bit about what you guys do at Mockingbird. It's a powerful ministry.
Sure. Well, we started, I guess, what feels like ancient history now, 2007, as an attempt to convey the grace of God in kind of in exciting and fresh ways, really using a bunch of kind of new media. We didn't totally realize at the time we were starting a platform, or what's become known as a platform, but right. we were coming from more like a mainline context and feeling like that the church, at least our version of it, was had become very moralistic and had mm-hmm. become very, you didn't hear much about Jesus at all, and you certainly didn't hear much about the grace of God for sinners. So
right.
we possibly in our hubris and our kind of youthful exuberance, we thought, wow, we can do this. And so myself and a bunch of friends and colleagues got together and started a website and started publications and conferences. And then we look back and it you know, it became this sort of interdenominational, I would say like reformational organization that is pioneered all sorts of different ways of conveying the grace of God to everyday people, translating stuff. We do a lot of stuff with kind of the intersection of faith and culture, but it's all in the service of, I guess, communicating, reclaiming, proclaiming the gospel in its kind of radical fullness. It's really foregrounding the grace of God. And so, you know, for listeners of Theocast, like, we're very keen on the distinction between the law and the gospel. Mm-hmm. We wrote a book about it early on. We actually just we're in the middle of finishing a second edition of it. But
really?
Yeah.
I promote that one all the time. It's great.
The theology of the cross, we talked about a lot. We talked a lot about mm-hmm. justification by faith. And so next to Mockingbird, which has grown and sort of changed in all sorts of interesting ways, we've gotten into the podcasting game too. Mm-hmm. I've also been writing my own books and trying to translate the distinctives that I think are most, I don't know, pastorally urgent, like justification by faith and the bondage of the will and the grace of God for, you know, the sort of sola gratia, into contemporary language. So we do it playfully. Yeah. We do it in all sorts of different ways. Sometimes we mess up, but that's what we've been up to.
No, I think that's a great way of describing it. What I love about what you do is that you take really, really hard concepts and you make them easy for the modern person to read without having to get a theological degree. I mean, that's important to do. Like, there's a place for that, just because I think the church has theologically become very ignorant and we just don't understand, I would even say, core doctrines even more. And so you guys are really good at pulling the clutter off the gospel, which is like happens all the time. Part of what this book is about, we're going to talk about today, is how we can even reinterpret the gospel of grace. What is grace? Mm. And then, justification, law, gospel distinction. I think you guys use culture and help people think through it. Not to steal any thunder. The only thing I'm going to mention about your book is that story about Daryl Strawberry.
Yeah.
I was on the plane and I was like crying. He was my hero too.
Really?
I was a huge Daryl Strawberry. Yeah, man. Because he eventually came and played for the Dodgers, so that's how I found out about him. Then I started following his career. I had no idea about that story.
Yeah.
So I'm on the plane, and I'm like crying. It's like, dude, this is such a powerful story of redemption, man.
Oh, we're the same generation. Because like Daryl Strawberry was a major figure for me. And he's
Oral Hershiser, Daryl Strawberry. Those are two guys that I obviously loved. So
Oral Hershiser. Yeah, I had to like, that was a, my mother, credits baseball cards with like teaching me to read and words like Oral Hershiser was not an easy word for an 8-year old to get his tongue around. So Strawberry,
I got
was a
to see
easier.
Him pitch. Yeah, I never saw Strawberry live. I did get to see Oral pitch before he retired, so that was fun. And great guy. I mean, you've got lots of kind of fun memorabilia behind you. We'll have to just do an episode of you walking through.
I mean,
stuff,
I'll just
man.
Show you one thing. This is the bobblehead of Daryl Strawberry when he was playing for the St. Paul Saints, when he was basically at his, when he was a dead
lowest.
Man, you know, when he was at his lowest, and the resurrection of Daryl Strawberry was, that happened there. So I'm a big Mets fan. That was, I grew up right around that time of that part of the country, that time of the 80s. And, but I only have his minor league. Someone gave that to me actually after I talked about that story. So.
Oh, there you go. So this will be my promotion for the book. That story and the Betty Crocker story, those two stories alone are worth reading the book. I'm probably going to steal your Betty Crocker study illustration, and I'll give you credit for it. Okay. But it was so good. I'm like, where is he going with this? What is the point of this story? And then I get to the end of it, and I was like, oh man, I'm stealing that. That's good.
Oh, thanks. I couldn't believe it when it came together for me. I was like, boop, boop. You know, that was the heavens open. I was like, well, that's about as clear an example of what I'm trying to get across as I could imagine.
Yeah. So. Well, I think that's why I love the book. So let's get into the book. We'll not hide it. So you have a new book called The Big Relief, The Urgency of Grace for a Worn Out World. And man, what a great title, because as a pastor, and so just for you know that, so David also, Mockingbird also part-time as at Christ Episcopal Church. Is that correct?
That's right. Here in Virginia? Here in Charlottesville. Yeah. So I preach. I'm not ordained and part of my denomination, but I'm a preacher and I do the adult education a lot. And I used to work with college students for years here at the University of Virginia.
Mm. See, that's why you have gray hair too. I worked with college students, and this is what happens when you work with college students.
I mean, yes, I will not argue with that.
I did it for 10 years. I loved it.
I miss
it. But they're all like, I know. They have so much energy. And they everything is out of 10 all the time. And it's like, I remember my wife and I would literally invite them to our home. We'd have like 30 college students there. Mm. And it would be like 11. And so I said, look, here's the rule. Lock the door on the way out. I'm going to bed. Because they would never leave. I'm like, you guys need to go home.
They soak up that sort of gracious environment when they get it. Because it's so much pressure and performance that they're under.
Yep. Speaking of, let's talk about the book. So I want you to buy this book. So we're not going to go through the book. I just wanted to give you two teasers there. But tell us a little bit about why you wrote the book and kind of the heart behind it. And then I want to talk about the subject of the book, because this is probably, there's nothing more important to me and something I love more than understanding how grace works. And in our world, we just do not understand how grace works. Mm. We just don't. And it's really, really sad. I think if Satan's done a brilliant job of anything, is he has changed the meaning of the word. It's totally transactional. So we'll get into that later. But talk us about where the book came from and why was it so important for you to write it?
Sure. Well, I mean, I'm a person who just naturally, dispositionally, attitudinally, gravitates towards grace. Someone was asking me why I wrote the book, and I said, you know, every single report card I ever got said some variation of David is very hard on himself. Some kind of variation of like he needs to. I wish he could take a little pressure off. He's got a very active inner critic, and you know, maybe everyone does. Some people are just better at hiding it, but the sort of internal scrutiny that I've lived under has always made me very thirsty for this message about the grace of God, that God actually is interested in me and loves me apart from my resume. And so there's something that just, I think like just, I'm naturally drawn to this and also therefore very allergic and sensitive to any forms of the Christian message that sort of smuggle in a bunch of conditions or fine print or something like that. Mm. But also, you know, I exist in the culture that we live in. I mean, I live in Central Virginia and I'm a middle-aged guy, but my experience of life is pretty much like things ramping up, treadmills getting faster as we get older, you know, ladders getting longer, and this sense that we're not only under internal pressure, but external pressure as well. We might, you know, Christians, we might call this the pressure of the law, or the pressure of sin and death, or the powers and principalities. There's any number of ways you could talk about it, but the experience of being a person, like the spiritual condition of being a person in this time, is one of existing under an enormous amount of burden that seems to be getting heavier. Mm-hmm. And I feel that's true for women. I feel that's true for older folks. I feel it's true for younger folks. I feel it's certainly true for college students, John. It's definitely true for podcasters and for people engaged in sort of entrepreneurial ministry online.
You just described my entire life. I have college students. I'm a podcaster. I'm a pastor.
Well, I think that, like, you know, if the gospel has something to say to us directly, who find ourselves in that position, let's foreground it. Let's talk about exactly what we mean when we say that God's disposition towards you and I is ultimately gracious. And so how can you do that, though, with language that can get past people's defenses? And so that's, I basically just took a lot of the stories and images and, you know, passages of scripture that have really gotten past my defenses, and I kind of organized them and tried to construct the different ways, the different sort of angles that grace sometimes takes. The challenge for me as a writer is always to provide a way in for folks so that, you know, maybe you're not in prison dealing with some vast, you know, infraction that you can't take back. And so some of the atonement language is not going to have emotional purchase for you right this second. It will eventually, but
sure,
maybe you need to hear a little bit more about, you know, forgiveness or rest, or maybe this is a time when you're very anxious about your status in the world, and the imputation of righteousness is going to be the arena in which your understanding of grace, you know, flowers at first. And so I'm just trying to catalog the various pressures that we live under and talk about how the grace of God addresses those things. So there's a kind of a, I wouldn't call it half-hearted because I put my whole heart into it, but to explore grace from a variety of different angles, always with the hope pastorally reaching people who are desperate for relief. Because this, the word relief is the title of the book, The Big Relief. And that was the word. I'm always looking for new, fresh words that can kind of give us a little, you know, fresh entree. But this word relief, I just kept hearing it everywhere. People would be like, oh, such a relief. Oh, I'm just dying for some relief. Oh, I need some relief. And it wasn't a question of like, if a person is looking for relief, it's like, what they're looking for relief from and where. Are they That's finding right. it at church? Sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah.
Not often. And no. Why not? And what is the message of the big relief at the heart of the Christian faith? And I think that's the grace of God. So.
Yeah, no, that's huge. So just like one more question about the book. So now that you're saying that, it kind of feel like each chapter, you're almost trying to describe a different person's experience. Is that what you're kind of going after?
Yeah, though I think that everyone has all these experiences at some point in their life.
Sure.
So if you're really sick and you're about to die, or you're, you know, in your 80s, you're going to be wondering about rescue from the grave, and in a way that you won't be when you're 25 and you just think you're never going to die. So it's, but I think that most of these are all coming from my own experience.
Sure.
In my own reading of scripture. Oh, the other thing I'd say, John, the heart behind it, like, because it does relate to college kids, in that I was talking to someone who, I told this story somewhere else, but it's really a true thing. It's not in the book. I was meeting with a guy.
Did you guys all hear that now? We're getting extra content here, so bonus. Here. That's bonus. Why you tune in to Theocast.
Free. We're talking to a guy who I used to do college ministry with, and we were talking about like just pastoral, you know, opportunities or the state of things. And he said, you know, like 15 years ago, when a young man would sort of say, I need to talk to you about something personal, like 9 out of 10 times it had to do with purity. Like almost always was related to, you know, the opposite sex or pornography or something like that.
Yep.
And he said, you know, something's changed. And now, like 9 out of 10 times, if a young man asks me to talk about something, he's going to disclose some sort of suicidal ideation. Like there's a mental health emergency that's about to be disclosed, and there's despair. Yep. And that is a shifting of the spiritual conditions. It's not a shifting of the gospel, but I feel the despair in our culture and in our moment. I see it myself. Is very potent and needs to be addressed. So if you're a Christian and you're not sort of talking about that despair that you see in your neighbors, but also the people in your church, like you may not be wasting your time. There are plenty of other things to talk about, but you need to have a good reason not to address despair head on. And that's what this book is really trying to do. That's why I say it's urgent.
So, well, and then that makes the word relief a whole lot more different versus like, I'm just not happy. You're saying I'm in despair and this book is going to offer relief. Now it's interesting you say that because in my church in this last year, I've had two, I'm going to protect them, but I've had two different individuals. I'll leave it that of separate genders, who have come in and they're like, I don't have any reason. Like I look at my life, I don't have any reason to be suicidal, but I am. And I don't know why. And I hate the fact that I feel this way. Like I feel ashamed of it, but yet it's something I truly wrestle with. And, you know, I have, it is interesting in that when I was doing, college ministry 15, 20 years ago, that I didn't hear that a lot, but in the last 5 years, I've had to walk several different high school students through their classmates committing suicide. And it's so.
And John, I don't know anyone who's involved in ministry who hasn't seen this in some respect. Like our church, and we're in this very affluent, you know, coastal elite place, and we had, you know, we buried 4 suicides last year, and that's a, that's not what it was. I mean, there's always people are always in agony and pain, but
To go to that level is a different level.
And to then to talk to other people in ministry and be like, yeah. It's true. It may not be quite as acute here in this situation as it is in this or among these groups or people, but it's rough out there.
It is. And that's what's interesting about your ministry and what you experienced, which is what ended up producing this book. What Theocast has been trying to do is that we want to offer hope over, you know, you mentioned this somewhere. I can't remember where you said it recently, but you're talking about how the internet can be extremely dangerous and very harmful. But it also can be, hopefully this episode, can be a mercy to someone to keep them from a moment of despair. And it's interesting how Satan can take something that is really good and turn it into something that is horrendous, like social media. You know, and I know a lot of you guys use social media, we do, and I know a lot of people have been benefited by it and have been hurt by it. But the question I have for you when I think about this, sometimes, David, when we say the word grace, or even God's grace, what you're trying to do in the book is help people, in my opinion, and you may not be doing this, so this is what I think you're doing. I think you're trying to help them reprogram their mind and using cultural examples of like, this is how you think grace works, but really this is how grace works. Like, and you use what I would say really good life examples to help people say, like to see like, these are really good examples. And I think at the end of the day, when we say the word gospel, God, or grace, those three words, they don't mean, culturally, they've not come to mean what the Bible wants, like what the Bible is communicating. And so what I'd love to do is just explain, because that's a big statement. I know I'm making a big claim here, but I kind of want to prove it to people. Like when I say the word grace, what comes to mind in David's mind today versus what would come to mind? Well, I mean, not necessarily you have to go biographical, but what you're dealing with as a pastor or in your ministry, because this is what at the heart of it, that this is what the book is. You're trying to help people redefine grace. So when you say you need God's grace and it becomes a relief to you versus grace is just one more way. It's an additive to help you.
Yeah. I mean, it is a big word. It means different things to different people. It means different things to different types of people, meaning like a ballerina means something different when she says the word grace than like one of my kids before dinner would say, let's say grace. And there's a sense of like, you know, if you read about what Roman Catholics have traditionally thought of grace as sort of like a substance that supercharges your willpower in some way or kind of helps you. Helps as you grow spiritual muscles in some way. And that's probably caricature, but I feel that grace is the term that we have for, well, in the Pauline epistles, it's gift. It's the way that God gives and to who, and God gives, you know, at a cost to himself, God gives to sinners, it's incongruous. And God gives super abundantly. God gives with no strings attached. It's not a bait and switch. So there's always, I get into grace through this sort of realm of gift. I mean, but, you know, John, when I was a youth minister, we talked about grace was unmerited favor. I still think that's a pretty good term. Like, especially as someone who's deeply afraid of rejection, like I'm interested in favor, and especially the unmerited kind. I like the merited kind as well, but
yeah,
I like unwarranted generosity is another good word for grace. I had a psychologist who was she was the wife of a theologian, and she defined grace as non-contingent, compassionate alliance. And I liked that. There are different ways to get into it. One way love is another euphemism for grace, but commonly what I've found in church circles, and I came through not just mainline circles, but sort of parachurch evangelical circles, grace was understood as God's sort of invitation that after which you received, and now it was time to get serious. And
that's right.
It was sort of the entrance ticket that God gives you into this new, what looks like, a generative, life-giving relationship, but sort of has a way of becoming a new treadmill and ladder and hierarchy and all these things that many of us who've been around the church long enough know all too well. So my sense of that God's grace is, I say in the book somewhere, I think it's the most evergreen reason for becoming a Christian and the most compelling reason for remaining one.
That's right.
So I don't think, and the reason, but Mockingbird, the whole idea behind it is that we're repeating the message we've heard over and over because we never graduate from our need for God's grace and forgiveness. If anything, life is sort of a continual journey. It's not linear. It's kind of cyclical, and we return again and again at different times of our life and in different ways.
If you're new to Theocast, you may not have heard of this word. It's called pietism. You ever felt like the Christian life is a heavy burden versus rest and joy? That you wake up worrying about how well you're going to perform instead of thinking about what Christ has done for you? It's dread versus joy, really. That's pietism. Pietism causes Christians to look in on themselves and find their hope, not in what Christ has done, but what they're doing. And we have a little book for you. It's free. We want you to download it. And we're going to explain the difference between pietism and what we call confessionalism. Reformed theology, really. How it is that we walk by faith, seeing the joy of Christ. And when Jesus says, come to me and I will give you rest, what does that look like? You can download it at our website. Just go to theocast.org. I think the way you're describing it, like for me, what changed the word grace for me was to take out the concept of any kind of transaction. That, because if we're going to be, you do a really good job in your stories of giving us really good hints of what God's grace looked like, but we don't know how to give each other grace. Because we're humans. Like, we're so transactional by nature. Like, when even you say you love your wife and I say I love my wife, if we're honest, that love was built on transaction. Like, we had to take and give and get to know each other and be like, are you good with it? I'm good with it. And then we kind of built this affection towards each other. Mm. And eventually it can get to the time where it's, you know, unconditional. But can you, if I just walked up to my wife and I'm like, I love you unconditionally and I want you to marry me. And she's like, that's fine. I don't love you unconditionally. You
Totally.
So human love is really hard because that's all we know. And so when someone says God loves you and he's gracious toward you and you're like, yeah, until he's not, until he's had enough of me, until like I finally crossed the line, because that's all we know. Like eventually, even if we say, oh, like I love my children unconditionally, like a parent can be pushed to a moment where it's like, man, this is really hard to love you. Like, I really don't want to give you this grace anymore. Mm. And so we always look this way instead of thinking about God's grace. It's like, yeah, you don't, because of sin and because of what Satan has done to the world, you have to get your understanding of grace from me. Because if you don't, it's distorted. It's distorted.
Yeah. I think, I mean, I think that we project our understanding of relationships onto our relationship with God. And that's why, in fact, the term relationship with God can be dangerous, because it's like, well, what sort of relationship? Is it just like these other relationships? Is God basically just a bigger, stronger, more powerful version of us? And like the revelation we have in the Bible of Christ crucified and raised is that no, God is actually different. And that's good. Mm-hmm. That's good news, because if God was just a supercharged version of you and me, that we would be in bad shape. So the task, therefore, in the book is to assemble all these hints and kind mm-hmm. of parables is too strong a word, but like certainly images that of echoes of God's grace and or of a different understanding of what grace looks like, and sort of compile them as much as you can, and then ultimately say, well, the only place where this is sort of purely expressed is, you know, on a hill in Calvary, you know,
that's right,
33 AD. So it's like, but I need to give you some imagery to so that you can grab a hold of it a little bit easier than just, sure. It's not just Vacation Bible School. So that's the challenge of a book like this, is to not replace the New Testament revelation with kind of a bunch of cultural examples, but to use those in the service of something becoming spiritually plausible for you today in ways that maybe you already know on some deeper level, but can't quite express. And that's the goal of the book.
Well, what I think is powerful about what you're doing, David, I mean, in your ministry, but also in the book, you know, the concepts of God's grace are so hard. Even Jesus himself uses parables. He's like, it's like a man in a field, right? Like he's using things we would understand so that we would then have a glimpse of God's glory and grace. And because it is, it's really hard. You know, it's like the only thing you can't do this with is the Trinity, because you end up falling into some kind of heresy.
Just no way to do it with the Trinity. Yeah.
Right. But with God's
grace. It's like
grace,
gas and ice and water. You know. Yeah, kind of. I don't know. Yeah.
That's Molinism, Patrick. Have you seen that? The Lutheran satire? You got to look it up. It's great.
Yes, I actually don't know that. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So, yes, no, this is powerful, because, like, there are a lot of things in life that, in my opinion, that I don't think you could ever get to the moment where you're done clarifying it or looking at it in a new light, in a new way. Mm. And I think this is what you're trying to do in the book, is like, we have been programmed to be introspective. We have been programmed to be programmatic and performance-based. Mm. And then we think, oh, God must think of me in this way. And the point of the book is like, no, here's the relief. Mm. God does not look at you how you look at you. This is wonderful, right? This is a good thing. And I think this is powerful, because to this day, I still struggle to think about grace in the right way. I still struggle to believe that God loves me unconditionally, because it's just not, it's something that's so foreign to our experience, right? Like it's not very often you see those. Now I think there are glimpses of it. In your book, you show some really powerful moments where, I was just rethinking back your whole polo, your water polo illustration.
Yeah, that was real. That's true.
I just want to know, did your coach ever read the book? That's all I want to know.
Not that I know of. I'm still waiting for his call.
you said at the reunion, you just want to kick him in the shins.
Yeah,
I literally laughed out loud.
Like God, maybe somehow I look back on that terrible experience from high school. John's referring to royally passed over in a election for a team captain, and you know, I think God is. It's safe to say there's been some redemptive work there by being able to. So because so many people identify with that example in some kind of mm-hmm. way. Yeah. But yeah, man, I think that sometimes people ask, why another book about grace? And I was like, well, first of all, the world feels more graceless than ever. Mm. I mean, I'm not sure it's ever felt very gracious. You know, I want to resist that kind of grumpy back in my day kind of thing. But it certainly feels pretty merciless. But second of all, like, why another sermon? You know, it's mm-hmm. if we the second we think we've got God's grace figured out, then we've certainly, that we know we haven't, because if it's divine, if it's truly alien and salvific and efficacious and all of these things that we hold dear, well, then it's not going to be my compromised faculties are not going to be able to ever fully grasp it. So if it truly is at the center of who God is in the world, then it passes understanding in a way that I think doesn't mean you then just sort of write it all off as mystery or something like that. But you do means like, no, my behavior and fearfulness and controllingness shows that I don't actually quite, there's so many ways in which I could go deeper into this subject.
Yeah.
I could become, but there are new, I guess, layers to unpack and unveil. And so I don't think it's a subject, if you're honest with yourself, that it's ever one that you kind of exhaust, because it's inexhaustible truly.
Yeah. I want to give some examples of that you and I have, I've been around ministry long enough. We've had to walk through various in our own personal lives as well, in our own marriages, in our own parenting. You get to a moment where we don't want to believe the passages about the curse and the fall. Like those parts we don't want to believe. Like, you're going to die. Most likely you're going to suffer when you die. Mm-hmm. Most people do. And then most likely nothing will go the way you think or want it to go, because you live in a fallen, sinful, horrible world, right? People get cancer and they get hit by cars and they get taken advantage of and they get lied to. And the lie of Satan is that, well, it's this way because, and then he'll put a litany of things in front of you, which are opposite of the truth. It's this way because he made it this way, or he's caused many of this. But it will say, we have failed God, or God has failed you, or you didn't have enough faith, or you didn't have enough discipline, or whatever you want to put in there. And yet, on the other hand, Paul's writing to us, and Peter and James, and they're like, listen, when you come into trials, you need to understand, first of all, this is the result of the curse. And two, you're not, even though you may suffer in this life, you're not without hope. Like this, like grace isn't just grace, like to pat you on the back and be like, God isn't just saying, hey, everything is okay. No, he's saying so much more than that. He's like, I have you. I love you. There's a lot more for you. Mm. We're setting our minds and our eyes on things that are far beyond this. So grace becomes the means to, like when Paul talks about when he's in his weakest moments, he's struggling, his faith is weak. He's like, but Christ's grace is sufficient for me. Mm. For what? To keep living, to keep having joy, to keep loving others, to like have a purpose for life. And this is where I think this book is so important to me. This subject is so important to me. I have seen enough people suffer. I've seen enough people die. And I have walked people through some of the darkest moments of their life. And the only thing I can tell them is, I can't reverse what happened to you. I don't have the power to fix it, but I promise you, God's love for you and his grace is sufficient. Like, it can give you a hope where there's hopelessness, energy where you feel like all you want to do is quit, and actually an actual purpose for life beyond what we think is like pleasure, success, and power. Because I don't know about you, David, but I've tried to pursue the pleasure, power, and protection, and it never works. And then when I dive into the grace of God, all of a sudden I'm like, I actually have a purpose for living. Like I want other people to know about this grace. And then I get excited because when they give grace back to me and that community happens, there's this, I'm going to say the illustration for later, because if I give it here, I can't give it later and I want to use it for later. I'll let you talk.
No. I just think that's the, We do see there's a distinction between communities that are shaped by grace and ones that aren't, and the ones that are pretty much shaped by the law. And it's not to say that the law is somehow bad, but if grace is our watchword, we know the difference between a situation in which we feel like we can actually bring our cares and concerns and our sin to God, rather than ones where we feel that's the last place we want to go with our sin. And of course that usually makes our problems worse. And life is so hard and a sin is so real, and I mean the devil is vicious, that our hope, to the extent it exists, has to rest on the grace of God. It has to, and, you know, as revealed in Jesus Christ. I really believe that, and as I get older, I don't believe that less. I sort of see it as more extreme, and rather than like, if anything, in youth ministry, we underdid it, because it's sort of, give me what is Leonard Cohen has a line in one song. He says, "Give me Christ or give me Hiroshima." It's like that's a heavy thing to say, but I feel like it, either God, there's a shred of the chance that at the center of the universe, there's a loving God who not only knows but has suffered with me and ultimately for me, or it's sort of turtles all the way down kind of thing. And so to my mind, a kind of a revelation of a more transactional, legalistic God is ultimately a council of despair, and it's a ministry it's a ministry of death is how Paul puts it. And yet you have this inverse, you have this crazy, or at least audacious, claim that God's strength is made perfect in weakness, and that God's grace is sufficient for you, no matter what you've done. There's still room for one more, kind of thing. That's what I think is most urgent. Why? That's why I call it urgent. You know, that's, it's hard to get people's attention these days. You know, the book came the same week that all the tariffs were announced, and you're just like, well, this is, that feels so urgent. And then the next week, trust me, it's something else feels super urgent. And
government shutdown.
And my, my conviction after 20 years of doing this and 20 years of in church ministry is like, actually the thing that's most urgent remains the most urgent is this revelation that God is not against you. And in fact, there's more for you than you could possibly imagine. And maybe, that's been true before, you know, before you could even realize it.
And I, especially as kind of going back to where we were a little bit to, and to bring this down, but the promise is this, is that God's grace is sufficient to help you wrestle through your anxiety, your depression, your doubts, your fears, your anger. Like these moments of like, I don't think there's a purpose in existence here. And the Bible says that you were made in God's image. He has, like, there has never been a moment of wasted pain and suffering. It's like, sometimes we think about it like, well, I'm just, my life is useless. Like, just look at it. And Jesus says, I actually died for you. I laid my life down for you. And I can hear you. I want you. No matter what you've done or what you think you've done, that the story of the woman at his feet who's weeping, I mean, that woman is looking at her life going, dude, this is not where I am. You know, she wasn't running around the cities of Jerusalem thinking to herself, I can't wait to blow my life up completely where the entire city hates me. And then she finds herself at the feet of Jesus. And what is he doing? He's showing compassion to her. He's loving her. He completely transformed her world, not because he says, if you perform well, you can transform your life. Here's the way out. He says, I'm your way out. And she saw it. You know, she loved much because she had been forgiven much. And that's at the heart of it, is that,
and all the losses brought her there, frankly. Like that's what that's the difficult thing to really keep in mind there, is that the loss, the suffering, is somehow God worked through that to that was a, probably another tool in the toolkit to bring this woman to the feet of Christ. Other, and her success wouldn't have done it, you know? I wish it could do that. Because we all seem so intent on chasing accolades and performance, and I am, you know, I deal with the same stuff everyone else deals with.
It's interesting to your point though, because like in the stories, it's like, who were the people that were most drawn to Jesus?
Yeah, it's those who had they had no eggs in their hands to use the reference Betty Crocker. But we don't want that to be true, because we hate the idea that all of our work and our hard, our knuckle to the grindstone isn't going to pay off in some kind of cosmic, exchange. But that the second we do fall on the face, the second we do, our internal impotence is revealed. Well, then all of a sudden the grace of God is the only thing we're interested in. It's not just one thing mm-hmm. we're interested in. It's like kind of, this is it. And those, I hate to say it, but I've also been around long enough to see that the folks who are really good at being spiritual and really good at being Christian and have a more transactional or more law-focused understanding of who God is, they end up hating God.
Yes.
They burn out, or they just say this was all a hoax, or I was sold a bill of goods, because you're mm-hmm. trying so hard and you're not getting God's not under your control in the way that you want him to be. And that's a heavy thing to say, and maybe I'll regret it, but I'm 47 and I've seen a lot of people.
I was just going to quote you. I'm like, that actually, that's probably the greatest way of describing legalism, is that we want to control God.
Exactly. That's all. It's original sin. Mm. What's wild here is that the Bible diagnoses this very clearly, is our desire to be God, or to control God, or to have God in our back pocket, is right there at the, you know, the Garden of Eden. That's part of the motivating rebellion. And that's what we do in all sorts of subtle, slightly more religious ways. Mm. And then the process of life is losing these things that you think you are owed or deserve, and then finding there's, like the woman at the well being driven to the feet of Jesus and realizing, wait, Jesus is better than I thought. He is he has not left me. I've learned something, in fact, through this defeat that I couldn't have learned any other way. And that there is life on the other side of death. That's both in the little deaths we die and in the ultimate one. So the hope with the book is to bring these things alive in ways that are, you know, I each chapter would have like something that's more cultural, something that's lighter, something's maybe funny, something's more personal, but then I'll go to the deepest things, like, or I'll try to get heavy. I'll try to not just, and there's always a bunch of scripture there. So,
it's great. The last thing I'll point to, I went and watched your advertisement for the book, cause I hadn't seen it yet. And I was curious what you'd done, cause you guys have always done some fun things in the past. Mm. And, what I loved at the heart of it, what you were saying, is that this isn't what you said, but this is what was communicated, is that once you understand grace, you just stop taking yourself so serious and you just learn how to have fun. Like, just relax and enjoy the good things that God has for you. You don't have to be so intense all the time. I get around people who are like really fit and motivated, and I'm like, good for them. But they're so intense, it exhausts me. I'm like, bro, like loosen up your belt just a little bit and just relax for a second. Dude, you're stressing me out, man. Like, you're so intent, like on like focusing on something. And this, I think this is what you're trying to get at, is that our culture gets us so, we're grinding. And there's like this never moment of joy and relax. And like, I'm good with the Father. The Father loves me.
Yeah.
Like, he's there for me. I don't have to perform in such a way that it's like, if I mess up once, you know, I say this all the time, that when God wrote the Bible to us, he wrote passages in there saying, hey, just so you know, you're going to sin. Mm. And if you don't think you have sin, you're totally confused, 1 John, but you are going to sin. Mm. And so there's mercy and grace for you, and there's repentance. And it's supposed to cause us to go, okay, I don't want to sin, but when I do, okay, there's a way for me to handle my sin. Okay, this is good because I do have a lot of sin and this is really bad.
There's a place to
go. But what I loved is that you had this moment where you're playing with your toys.
Yeah.
And I was laughing because you totally were not taking yourself serious. And that's what grace allows you to do. Be like, look, God loves me. He knows who I am. And whatever you think about me, that's fine. That you can think whatever you want. I don't find my identity and my satisfaction in what you think about me. I don't know if that's what you meant to say in the video, but that's what I laughed at. And I was like, I love this. This is good advertising.
That came across. That's my hope. I think that.
Good. There you go.
I think my faith, the assurance of God's grace is the bedrock of my faith. And that means that I approach the world. On my best days, I approach the world from acceptance, from approval, from God's love, rather than for it. And that's freedom. And I think that that's the foremost fruit of that. If I'm taking it seriously, the funny thing is I take the gospel seriously, then there's freedom to kind of play and to enjoy life and the world and creation and to serve your neighbor and to do all the things that, but without this grim, the apocalyptic sense, like the ultimate answers have been given. Like, let's, you know, see where I can be useful with the gifts God has given me. I think there's a freedom, a playfulness, and the first fruits of it are usually a bit of lightness and humor. Playfulness. That's,
I love it, because
you can't,
you got all that stuff behind you,
but you can't convey. I'm convinced at this point, John, like, you cannot convey the grace of God in an overbearing, you know, oppressive way. Like,
that's right.
And people do it. And, you know, you and I know from plenty of this kind of more confessional circles where it's very grim declarations and assertions about how incredibly gracious God is. And you're like, well, something's not computing for me here. So to talk about freedom in a freely and to talk about grace graciously, that's the deepest hope of this book, because I don't think the world actually needs, we need God, we need the Holy Spirit, we need more grace, but we don't actually, the answer to the world on fire is not a upping of human self-seriousness. I believe it is sort of the this counterintuitive proclamation of the grace of God that often it motivates people to love and serve and to sacrifice and to not only did not take themselves that seriously, but to give themselves for others.
That's right.
I long to see that. But ultimately, right now, I just long for people to experience a little relief, because I don't think we're in...
little relief.
We're in danger of too much relief. We're in danger of crushing, despair-inducing amounts of pressure within the church as well as outside of the church. And I'm speaking... So I'm writing this book to myself, hoping that other people may get to overhear something that's of use.
Yeah. Well, I've been doing this lately. I've been doing some book interviews that I think are helpful for everyone. For those of you that are parents and you have children that are in high school, college, definitely pick this book up and tell them they should read it, because it's going to help them start thinking through a lot of these issues that are compounding their heart. You know, I have a 21, 19, and 17-year-old who at times they feel these pressures. They feel them from their friends. They feel them from culture. They feel it on social media. And I want to be able to hand books like this to say, here's another way of thinking about Christ for you, to give you some relief, to help you. You know, you're about to make some big decisions. And then for those of you that are 80 years old and you're thinking, man, my life did not turn out the way I think it was supposed to turn out, you need to read this book, because God has you exactly where he wants you, and you need to read this and be encouraged by it. So anytime I find a really good book, and I would recommend just typing in David Zoll's name and whatever he's written, go ahead and grab it. Low Anthropology was great. Seculosity, we went through as a church. I couldn't recommend it more. It's a great book. So, well, that was like 10 years ago. How long ago was that? 7 years ago?
Seculosity? Yeah, 2019.
Yeah, 19. Okay, so 6 years ago.
Yeah, I wish that one...
Time flies.
I wish that one had dated more, but good Lord.
Yeah. If you would like to learn more, David has lots of articles, podcasts, he does Mockingcast, a lot more information. Just go to his ministry, Mockingbird, and promise... Is it Mbird? Mbird.org, is that correct?
Mbird.com, yep. Or Mockingbird.org, yep.
Either one. And you can learn more about David. Hey, brother, it's so good to reconnect, man. Good to have you back on. Anytime you want to come back on and promote anything, just let me know. You can come on, because I just enjoy talking to you.
John, you're too kind. Thank you for all that you do with Theocast.
Yeah.
I see the fruit everywhere I go. So I'm not saying that idly. And thank you. I know it takes a lot of work, actually, to talk this much about grace. So I'm not... Well done, my friend. And thank you for the encouragement you've given me today.
I appreciate it, man. Love you, brother. We'll talk soon. Hey, guys, real quick. Some of you are listening to this and it's encouraging to you, but you have questions. So where do you go? How do you interact with other people who have the same questions and share resources? We have started something called the Theocast Community, and we're excited because not only is it a place for you to connect with other like-minded believers, all of our resources are there. Past podcasts, education materials, articles, all of it's there, and you can share it and ask questions. You can go check it out. The link is in the description below.